Megan O'Rourke's mother, Barbara, died of colorectal cancer when she was just 55 years old in 2008 on Christmas Day. At the time, Megan was a 32-year-old editor and critic who'd recently published a well-received book of poetry called Half-Life. She visited us in April to discuss her memoir, The Long Goodbye, where she describes finding herself unprepared and overwhelmed with grief, but finally coming to terms with her mother's death. Listeners told us how moved they were by our conversation, and we thought we would rebroadcast it today. I began by asking Megan O'Rourke, isn't The Long Goodbye the title of a Raymond Chandler novel, which was also made into a film by Robert Altman?
It is. I'm hoping that I might lure some of those viewers over to my very sad book.
But there's not really much of a mystery here.
Well, you know, it's funny. A friend of mine read the book and said that it actually has a little bit of a quality of a mystery because there's this sense of searching, the mystery of what happens to someone who's gone, that you're kind of always searching for them. But no, otherwise, not much of a mystery.
Did you have much warning that your mother might die?
Yeah, so my mother was diagnosed with stage 4, which is metastatic colorectal cancer, in May of 2006. So for 2.5 years, almost 2.5 years, we knew that she was very, very ill. But during that period, she went through a remission. She had various success with different therapies. And it's a very strange world that I think a lot of people live in, which is this world of anticipating that somebody probably will die, but not knowing if or when that will actually happen.
So were you surprised by how devastated you were when she did die?
You know, yes and no, right? I mean, I was, because I thought, well, I've had all this time to prepare, right? And that's, in fact, something that various people said to me was, well, you knew your mother was going to die, so it couldn't have been that much of a shock. But again, it's, as those who I think have experienced it, it's just an utter shock. As I say somewhere in the book, the fact of someone being dead is very different from the idea of their being dead. And
so you never really can prepare yourself
completely.
You can
never prepare yourself completely. And that's part of what grieving becomes, right? It becomes the mourning of the absence. And it's just a period you have to go through, I think, or I had to go through.
Well, there are different communities that have ways of dealing with it afterward. There are the Irish Wakes. Jews sit Shiva for a few days. But you seem to feel that couldn't apply to you. Megan O'Rourke couldn't have had an Irish wake?
Well, you know, certainly we did have a funeral for my mother, and we did have a kind of Irish wake where her sisters, she came from a family that was full of merriment and storytelling and laughter, and her sisters came over, and we told very funny stories about my mom, some of them about how she had run off with my father when she was 17 and all of these kind of great memories. But what I was trying to talk about in the book was the absence of ritual that surrounds a loss in sort of a long-term way. So while there was one funeral, you know, people come to your house and then 4 hours later they're gone. And that felt really abrupt. And it felt like there was this really uncomfortable period of trying to figure out, how do I go back to work? How do I go back to talking to my friends? And everyone's very uncomfortable and awkward around death because we don't have a great language for it.
And in this country, people are less likely to wear black all the time.
Yeah, well, you
rend their garments.
Exactly. And you can appreciate this, and I'm sure all your listeners who are New Yorkers can appreciate this, but I remember having to get on the subway, you know, 3 days after my mom died, and some woman elbowed me, and you know, just was a crowded subway. It wasn't her fault, but I basically just about burst into tears, and I, you know, wished that I had some signal that I was sort of felt precarious, you know.
In a review in yesterday's New York Times, Dwight Garner described this as a poet's book in the urgent clarity of its observation. How much do you imagine that your training as a poet influenced the way that you were affected by your mother's death?
That's a really interesting question.
Because words are important to you, and I'm sure that all the time you were thinking about, you might even have been writing things in your head.
Yeah, no, it's such a great question. You know, as my mother was ill and as she was dying, I found myself scribbling down things that she said. For one thing, she had a brain tumor near the end, and so she would say these very strange and sometimes very beautiful things. One of them was, we were watching TV one night. Actually, we were watching Lost, and there was a storm on the TV show, but there was also a windstorm outside. And she was trying to figure out what she was hearing, and she looked at me and she said, "Is that our wind that I hear?" You know, it was such a beautiful phrase. So certainly I think that my training as a poet was behind my impulse to write down what took place, because I was trying to kind of anchor in language and in metaphor just this rupture that I had felt between the old world and the new and the present and the past.
In his Times Review, Dwight Garner also called your book a sustained howl of pain and suggested that it might be too ripe and intense for some.
Yeah, I saw that. And certainly, I think that that's his response, and that's a totally fair response. It certainly, there's a lot of pain in it, but I really believe, and also have had other people say to me that the book, you know, there is a lot of love in it, right? And this is a thing that anyone who's grieved knows, is that grief is the flip side of love. And so I see this book as also being profoundly about love and about childhood and memory and those.
And a bit of a tribute to your mother, because wasn't she the one who taught you years earlier to write about your feelings in order to better understand them?
Yeah, she just thought I would get a kick out of writing, right? She had a great sense of humor, and she was a very playful person. So her example to me was she gave me a corduroy-lined notebook and said, here, you should write things down, funny things that you see. And I said, like what? And she said, like, maybe you saw a woman with purple hair crossing Montague Street. And certainly she would have wanted, you know, there are a couple of funny stories about her in this book, and she those are the parts of the book she would love the most, I think.
Well, she was a teacher.
Yes.
So was she being a teacher then? That's the sort of thing you might tell a student to do as well.
Absolutely. She was just very natively a teacher, and she took a lot of delight in the world. And she was a teacher because she was also, I think, a perennial student. You know, she was always kind of carrying her Audubon bird books everywhere and trying to make lists of the birds she'd seen and so on. And she had a great sense of hilarity, and I try to capture some of that.
She taught at St. Dan's in Brooklyn?
That's right.
And your father, too?
And my father, too. They were both teachers and administrators there, yeah.
That wasn't intimidating at all, especially when you went to St. Dan's?
Oh, it was totally intimidating. Are you kidding? I feel like probably I'm still sort of, you know, writing things down and offering them up to her in some way, right? Here's my book, Mom.
Did I do the assignment as it was told to do?
Right.
Megan O'Rourke has written a memoir called The Long Goodbye. It's published by Riverhead. Would you read a bit for us?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to read a passage from a short period when my mother was in the hospital near the end of her life, just to capture some of the kind of feeling of the tornado of being in that world. One of the ideas I've clung to most of my life is that if I just try hard enough, it will all work out. If I work hard, I will be spared, and I will get what I desire, finding the cave opening over and over again, thieving life from the abyss. And so in the hospital, I was always eager to show the nurses what I knew, how much I had learned, including the fact that I had to prostrate myself before their wisdom, experience, and sore feet. I was the model relative, slipping out along the linoleum hallway in my thick stay-over socks, delicately catching the attention of the receptionist and saying, I see that my mother's morphine is about to run out. I wonder if someone could change it before it starts beeping and wakes her. I know, leaning in confidingly, like a student bowing her head to a good teacher, that we need to stay ahead of the pain. I would pause a beat. I know you're all so busy, I just don't want my mother, a slight stress on the word, another pause, almost imperceptible, so that the nurse could think, my mother, and remember her own mother, to suffer. And I'd exhale, and the strapped receptionist wouldn't smile, but she would say, I'll try to signal the floor nurse for you, honey. Doctors and nurses are the family members' priests. We supplicate them, please let us go, just let us go home. We recite their catechism. We assure them we will not blame them. We just want her to be at home. We will not sue you.
Megan O'Rourke reading from her memoir, The Long Goodbye, published by Riverhead. And when it was clear that your mother had exhausted all available medical treatments, you and your family did bring her home to die. Why that rather than to a hospice?
Well, we had hospice at home. So you can have hospice, you can be in a hospice or you can have hospice at home. And in our case, my mother very much wanted to be at home. She wanted to be able to look out the window at trees that she knew. And we had the means to be at home. I mean, I was working as a teacher, so I could spend time with her. It is definitely a very challenging experience, but we wanted to be there for it.
And it was right before the Christmas season, her favorite holiday.
Yeah, so it was right before Christmas.
Sometimes we imagine that people hold on until something happens. Do you have that feeling that she held on until Christmas Day?
Definitely. You know, she kind of went without water or any food for about 7 days, and we all thought she would die before Christmas, but she had told me in the hospital a few weeks earlier that she wanted to just make it till Christmas. And in fact, it was right after we opened our presents sitting around her that she passed away. And I do think she knew she was with us and she knew what was going on.
One of the things that struck you after your mother died was just how lonely mourning turned out to be. Didn't you often feel like your sadness made other people feel uncomfortable?
Definitely. And, you know, I think that's a big part of why I wrote this book was I wanted to create a kind of interior record of what mourning was like, because certainly it was not something I understood at all before I went through it. And one thing that I really want to capture, and this is where I think, you know, the kind of howl of pain is part of the book, but not all of it, is that mourning isn't just sadness. It's a whole host of things, you know, and some of them are physical, like having trouble sleeping, but some of them have to do with just the way your mind works. I was very distracted because I was thinking about all these memories of my mother all the time. And again, I think this is a very common kind of experience that people had. And I wanted to try to hopefully make that experience feel a little bit less lonely by putting it on the page in an accessible way.
A friend of mine remembers all the people who didn't call when his mother died, and he's resenting them, but you seem to have a bit of sympathy for them. They didn't know what to say, you say, or were afraid that they might say the wrong thing.
Yeah. Now, look, I mean, I definitely was angry, you know, had my moments of being angry, but I also thought this is a conundrum we all have, which is we just, you know, I remember being scared of what to say, that I would say the wrong thing. And so what people do is they don't say anything at all, which I think actually makes it much harder for everyone.
Well, you say there's a certain amount of taboo connected to all of this. It's easier in our society to talk about incest or having worked in the sex trade when you were a kid than to talk about mourning for a loved one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk about it in books, but we're really bad at talking about it in a room with one another. And again, I think when we do, we have this therapeutic model of it, which is one thing a lot of people said to me is, well, you know, one day you'll feel better, or soon you'll heal, or here's what you'll do to let go. And again, when you've just lost someone, you don't feel that you have a disease. You just feel that you're mourning someone's death, and you want to just be given space, or I want to be given space to do so.
Well, there were a slew of memoirs about overcoming addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But recently we've seen several books about grief and bereavement. We had Joan Didion's book a few years ago, and then just within the last few months, Joyce Carol Oates' A Widow Story and Francisco Goldman's Say Her Name. I don't know if you've read those books.
I have. They're both wonderful.
And did you see any similarities in their responses?
Definitely. You know, I think that for one thing, I think Francisco Goldman talks about this. I think none of us felt that the so-called five stages of grief, which again is that therapeutic model that, you know, you reach acceptance, had any application to our lives. I think the other is that, you know, one of the strange things about grief is that certain aspects of the world can become almost more vivid. And there's this impulse to record or to memorialize that I saw in all of our books, that each one of us in our way felt this very painful but also kind of beautiful need to put down on the page something about the person that had gone before.
Well, there's almost a certain amount of pressure on you to get past it. And you say you sometimes felt ashamed of how great your grief was and wondered if it was normal to feel so sad for so long.
Absolutely. I mean, I think within a month I felt that I got the feeling that, and not in a malevolent way, just in a sort of, oh, well, surely you've accepted this and now it's time to move on. And again, I think because my mom was sick for so long that, you know, something I say in the book is other people accept your mother's death or your partner's death, but long before you accept it. And so you have to deal with that dissonance, right? You have to kind of keep living with it. And it can feel, if you're a certain kind of person, like you're failing to kind of pick yourself up and move on.
There's also the complication when a parent is ill, might die, when you're still fairly young, of the reversal of roles. Your mother had retired, was living in Connecticut at that point?
Well, she was actually working. I mean, she worked up until a month before she died. And, you know, she had to take a lot of time off, but she was trying to work. She was running a school, actually, in Westport, Connecticut. And, of course, other people had to step in to help. But because she was, you know, one of the great shocks of this death was that she was a very vital person, and she was in other ways very, very healthy, even though she was quite sick. So it seemed improbable that she should have died.
Yeah. But did your relationship with her change during the time that she was ill?
Yeah, it really did. You know, we, for one thing, exactly what you're talking about, I became a caretaker at different parts, just like my brothers did. And that, you know, carries a lot with it. And it requires a having to kind of let go and move on and grow up. But we became much closer. You know, we had grown us slightly apart, just in the way that adult children do. And during those last months, we got to kind of tell each other things and sit in bed together and and do a lot of goofy things too, like go shopping.
It took me a long time to get past, after my mother died, the thought I would have something would occur to me, and I'd think, oh, I'll call mom and clear that up. And then I'd have to go through this whole process of saying, oh, I can't do that.
It is so strange.
It no longer happens to me, but it was years before that disappeared.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you the truth. Like, even this morning, I woke up and I was like, oh, I have to tell mom that my book is coming out, you know? And I just had this feeling. And it's obviously very strange to have a person that I would be the primary person I would talk about all this with not be here, you know? And I'm also like, what would she think? And she would find this funny. And she'd be like, did you really have to tell them that about this, you know?
I've spoken to some poets about how long it takes to write a poem about something that is really powerful in one's life. It's not something you can sit down and do 2 days after the event. Have you written any poems in regard to this?
I have now written some.
But was it easier to write prose?
Much easier to write prose. In fact, I think I said somewhere, like, you know, when my mother first died, I had this impulse to write. Again, I think that's just because how I make sense of the world. It made me feel safer that, you know, my identity had been ruptured, but at least I could return to language. But I could not write poems. It felt like I was falling into a well when I was trying to write a poem. There was so much openness. But what I could do is try to write in prose, which was almost like, it almost was like guy ropes along a, you know, steep cliff. I could use the sentence to pull me to the next sentence and just try to put down some of what had happened and my memories of her. So... But now I've written a few poems, but again, writing the poems about her is very, very difficult.
Do I have the feeling that you'll continue writing for a while about this and until you've come to a point where you can start moving on to other things?
Well, you know, it's been very interesting. I definitely feel with the publication of this book that, you know, a certain period of my mourning has come to a close. And so I am feeling a real appetite to do other things. And, you know, one thing that's very strange when you write a memoir is that the person in the book is not necessarily the person I am now. So the mourner who's present in the book is very different from the mourner I am even 2.5 years later.
But through the process of writing the
absolutely,
book.
Absolutely, you know. But I am sure that in so many ways I'll keep writing about this without even knowing I am, for sure.
Megan O'Rourke is the author of Half Life, a collection of poetry. She's a cultural critic for Slate, and her essays and poems have appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, other publications. Her new book, a memoir, is called The Long Goodbye. It is published by Riverhead